ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 21st of May. I'm Barbara Miller, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. As the diphtheria outbreak continues to spread, states and territories are anxiously waiting for support from the federal government to ramp up immunisations. More than 220 cases of the dangerous infection have been recorded this year, most among Indigenous populations in the Northern Territory and Western Australia. Isabel Musali reports.
Carl Briscoe can't stress enough. The diphtheria outbreak must urgently be stopped. He's the CEO of the National Association of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Workers and Health Practitioners, and a Gugu Yalanji man.
Unlike the syphilis outbreak, it spread pretty quickly. And so jumping on this very quickly and taking emergency action is the key priority here.
Diphtheria is a highly contagious bacterial infection that affects the nose, throat and airway, or the skin. With cases climbing, Federal Health Minister Mark Butler has confirmed there'll be a support package that'll focus on boosting vaccinations. Carl Briscoe says it's a great start, but stresses there must be a workforce boost and a coordinated national approach that listens to Indigenous people.
We saw in COVID one of the other lessons was the locking down of communities. We didn't see one Indigenous death in the first 12 months by that advice being taken up. I'm not saying locking down communities with diphtheria, but I'm saying listening to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's voices.
NT Chief Health Officer Dr. Paul Burgess explains diphtheria is treatable with antibiotics and vaccination is effective for preventing severe illness.
A long-term relationship with communities and trust is really important. And we did lose significant staff members following with COVID. However, there's broader factors at play internationally and also nationally. We've seen, particularly since COVID, a rise in vaccine hesitancy and sadly also misinformation and disinformation.
Dr. Linnie Fong is a paediatric infectious diseases physician at the University of Melbourne and the Murdoch Children's Research Institute.
What we know about the primary series of vaccinations, which include diphtheria, tetanus and pertussis, is that at 12 months of age, there has been a decrease in vaccination rates in children. And we know that there's been an even lower rate amongst our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities.
With the diphtheria outbreak, Dr. Fong is concerned that the majority of cases are in Indigenous communities and in remote areas.
It's not just vaccination. We really need to get better at ensuring that vulnerable populations are able to, one, access healthcare, but two, that their social conditions are improved.
In a statement, a spokesperson for the Department of Health said the federal government is focused on delivering a comprehensive, multi-layered approach to lift vaccination rates for childhood vaccines nationally, and that includes strong engagement with First Nations communities.
Isabel Musali reporting. 9 days on from the budget, the federal government is on the defensive over its plans to overhaul the country's capital gains tax regime. The government's standing by its decision to scrap a 50% capital gains tax discount from July next year. Oliver Gordon reports.
41-year-old Gold Coast resident Simone is in the process of buying a security company.
We've saved a bunch of money to be able to get to a position where we could purchase this. We've taken equity out of our home and, put that money on the line to buy it.
She was originally looking to purchase the business, expand it, then on sell.
But we probably won't do that now because why would we? What's the incentive for later?
The federal government's overhauling how the profits from selling investments like shares, houses or businesses are taxed. It's getting rid of the 50% capital gains tax discount, which allowed people to only pay tax on half the profits their investments made. Council of Small Businesses Chief Executive Sky Capuccio says many of her members are concerned they'll face a tax hit.
Concerned that this will amount to a higher taxation or a higher CGT taxation when they come to sell.
Under the new rules, each year, the purchase price of your investment is updated to adjust for inflation. Then, when you go to sell your investment, you're required to pay a minimum 30% tax on the real profit. That is, the profits made on the updated purchase price. The government has argued up to 90% of small businesses won't be impacted and say scrapping the straight 50% discount is key to making housing more affordable. But CEO of the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, David Alexander, sees the changes as overreach.
Seems like there's an unintended consequence of moving to address what they see as a problem in investment in established real estate, and they're unintentionally hitting the broader business community.
The business leader says the government's proposed tax changes, which will also increase taxes on trusts, are anti-business.
It's going to financially penalise businesses, SMEs that use trusts, make them less able to conduct their business.
The coalition has pledged to repeal the planned changes, but the government is standing by them, saying they apply a fairer, more neutral tax treatment to different types of assets. It's also vowed to keep consulting, particularly with the startup sector. Meanwhile, economists are canvassing changes that could see the government meet business halfway.
There is what's called the small business concession in the CGT arrangements, but that has not been indexed since 2007, right?
Contributing economics editor at The Australian, Judith Sloan, says the government should update its definition of what a small business is so more businesses can access concessions to CGT rules.
So at the moment, you basically don't pay any capital gains tax on the sale of a business if the revenue's under $2 million and its value's under $6 million. But that has not changed in all that time, so in nearly 20 years. So one obvious solution for this government would be to say, okay, we'll change those, we'll indeed index those thresholds.
As debate continues, the man who introduced the capital gains tax back in 1985 has issued a missive signing off from Potts Point. Former Labor Prime Minister and Treasurer Paul Keating backing in the proposed changes to capital gains taxes, suggesting they arrest a distortion that has made housing unaffordable for a whole generation.
Oliver Gordon and Stephanie Smale with that report. The federal government has announced an additional $91 million in funding for the Great Barrier Reef. Environment and Water Minister Murray Watt says the money will help secure the future of one of Australia's greatest natural assets and the jobs that depend upon it. The announcement comes just weeks out from the release of a draft decision on the reef's conservation status ahead of a July meeting of UNESCO's World Heritage Committee, with fears it could be listed as in danger. The Environment Minister joined me from Cairns. Murray Watt, thanks for speaking to AM.
No problem, Barbara. Good to be with you.
What will this package deliver on the ground?
Well, I think all Australians know that the Great Barrier Reef is an international icon. It's home to incredible and unique species that aren't found in any other part of the world. And it attracts millions of visitors from all over the world. And of course, importantly, it's the backbone of so much of regional Queensland's economy, creating about 77,000 jobs every year. And that's why this year's federal budget has committed another $92 million to protect and restore this iconic reef that's known around the world. Basically, the funding is a mixture of expanding existing programs that we've had in place for a while with the Queensland government, including things like lifting the reef water quality, but also increasingly helping the reef adapt to climate change, for example, by funding new techniques of coral spawning, which can help reefs recover from coral bleaching events. There's a range of other initiatives in there, but as I say, what it comes back to is making sure that we protect and restore the Great Barrier Reef for generations to come.
So we're expecting in the next few weeks a draft decision on the reef's conservation status. That's ahead of a meeting in July of the World Heritage Committee. How concerned are you that the reef could be placed on the in danger list?
It's certainly always a concern, Barbara. I mean, our very strong position is that listing the Great Barrier Reef as in danger won't do anything to protect the reef. And it certainly, you know, it hasn't stopped us continuing to invest and taking action to protect the reef. We are committed to doing that. And a listing of that kind won't alter that. It won't help with that protection effort. What it would do is deal a very damaging blow to our tourism industry internationally. The Great Barrier Reef is one of the key reasons that international tourists come to Australia, not just to Queensland, but they might come to the reef first and then visit other parts of the country. If the reef is listed as in danger, we do believe that would deter international tourists from coming to Australia, having big economic damage, while not doing anything to lift the reef's protection. And that's why we're fighting so hard to resist that in danger listing, while of course undertaking big investments and big changes to our law to protect the reef well into the future.
As you say, there has been significant investment promised through till 2030. 91 million is really a drop in the ocean. Is this announcement ahead of the draft decision more about optics?
No, well, of course, you know, the federal budget comes down in May every year, and that's the appropriate time for us to be making these times of announcements. It happens to be fairly close to UNESCO making that decision, but I can assure you we didn't arrange the date of the federal budget around that. But I think it is a good reminder to UNESCO that we remain committed to do this. It comes on the back of billions of dollars of other work that we're doing. I do think the UNESCO is impressed by the work that we're undertaking. They have said so previously, and they can see that we're pulling every possible lever towards that protection. It wouldn't surprise me if they want to, you know, can remain engaged in what we are doing, because they have an interest in protecting this icon for the world at large. But I'm very confident that we can persuade them that the work that we're doing is geared towards making sure that those beautiful coral, fish, turtles and other marine life that live in this spectacular place will be there for a very long time to come.
Murray Watt, thank you for joining AM.
Thanks, Barbara.
Environment Minister Murray Watt speaking to me from Cairns. The US government has indicted former Cuban President Raul Castro on charges of conspiracy to kill US nationals over a fatal attack on two planes in 1996. It's the latest move in the Trump administration's pressure campaign against Cuba's communist government. North America correspondent Cayman Gok is in Washington. Cayman, talk us through the details of this indictment.
Well, Raul Castro has been charged with conspiracy to kill US nationals, destruction of aircraft and murder charges. And these relate to an incident 30 years ago where two American civilian small planes were shot down over international waters in 1996. Four people died and three of those were Americans. And prosecutors allege it was Raul Castro, who was then the Armed Forces Minister, who approved the use of deadly force. These planes were operated by Brothers to the Rescue, which was a humanitarian organisation that carried out regular flights attempting to help Cubans who were trying to flee the United States. Now, the current Cuban government has dismissed these charges as political and without legal foundations, and it claimed that it acted in self-defence at the time in the 90s, following repeated violations of their airspace. Now, these charges which have been laid, they're unlikely to see the now 94-year-old extradited to the United States, given he was former leader and is still considered the de facto leader and a political mover behind the scenes. But regardless, the United States Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche insists that this indictment is not a symbolic one and that the United States will have justice. Take a listen.
We expect that we didn't indict. This isn't a show indictment. This is an indictment because we expect that there was a warrant issued for his arrest. So we expect that he will show up here by his own will or by another way and go to prison.
By another way. Cayman, this seems like a significant escalation. It's all part of a broader effort by the White House to exert pressure on Cuba. We also heard Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, addressing Cubans directly in Spanish ahead of the announcement of this indictment. What's your read on where relations currently stand between Washington and Havana?
Well, President Trump has made it no secret that he wants to see regime change in Cuba. And given the military success the United States had back in January in Venezuela with that brazen raid to depose then President Nicolas Maduro, Trump has since warned that Cuba is next. Now, the United States has effectively blockaded the country and has ramped up sanctions and has also made veiled and not so veiled threats. The impact of these embargo as well has only worsened the country's energy crisis, as it is now regularly experiencing fuel shortages and long blackouts. So it's tightening its economic grip. But Donald Trump says that he doesn't think that there will be an escalation between the two countries. He said that today. And in the past, he has said that he hopes to strike a deal through diplomacy. But in saying that, he was also asked today if we could potentially see a similar operation like the one we saw in Venezuela, and he wouldn't comment. And also today, a US aircraft carrier strike group arrived in the Caribbean too. So, you know, while many experts believe the United States wouldn't want to engage in another military intervention or operation whilst the Iran war goes on, the United States is no doubt laying the groundwork for that possibility. And we heard from Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, earlier today when he was making that address in Spanish. He was essentially blaming the failures of the Cuban government, the Cuban regime, for the poor quality of life that Cubans are experiencing, saying it's not necessarily the blockade that the United States has put in place, but the poor management of the communist country. Now, Cuba has called this indictment a political provocation. And in a statement from the government, it said it was highly cynical of the accusations, given the fact that it was made by the same government that's killed nearly 200 people and destroyed 57 vessels in international waters. And that's referencing the United States strikes on alleged drug boats in the Pacific and the Caribbean. So it's also warned as well that if there was any military intervention in the country, it would lead to a bloodbath. So strong words from both sides.
Cayman Gawk in Washington. Almost 60% of Australian parents are experiencing psychological distress with flow-on effects to their children. That's the finding of a national survey of 10,000 parents, the largest to date. Here's National Education and Parenting reporter Connor Duffy.
Hi. William, where are you?
Melbourne mum Nicole Tandy loves to play hide-and-seek with her four-year-old son William. But juggling parenting, running a household and working two jobs often leaves her feeling lonely and overwhelmed.
I don't have the village. The picture that I'm seeing on social media of people is people really loving it, thriving as a parent. And I love being a parent, but I just think, like, I feel sometimes like nobody's talking about how hard it is.
Nicole says parenting in survival mode makes it harder to be the parent she wants to be.
Feeling overwhelmed means I might have less patience. I could definitely be more snappy. And then that kind of just contributes to that feeling of like shame and guilt. Like, I really want to do this and do a great job and show up as a parent, but I'm doing a billion things. Yeah, it's really hard to balance it all.
A national survey of 10,000 parents has found many are struggling with poor mental health. Lead researcher Dr. Catherine Wade from the Parenting Research Centre says loneliness, self-doubt and low self-compassion are key drivers.
12% of Australia's parents are reporting psychological distress in the high range. So that's, you know, clinical levels of depression and anxiety. But in addition, 45% of Australia's parents seem to be reporting moderate levels of psychological distress.
The research also shows the struggles are universal, and Dr. Wade says they cut across gender, education levels and income groups.
The struggle and the juggle is real. When they're feeling under pressure themselves, they're less likely to do the sorts of parenting behaviours that we know children need to thrive.
Dr. Wade says peer support programs can help parents feel less isolated and have more self-compassion. Demographer Dr. Liz Allen from the Australian National University warns the impact extends beyond families.
Poor mental health among parents could be partially to blame for declining birth rates in Australia. Australians are having fewer children, and that's not because they necessarily want fewer children. It's because life gets in the way. Life is simply too stressful.
Dr. Allen says the solution can't be left to individuals or communities.
We require structural change, a rethink in the financial supports for families, a reconsideration of what work looks like.
What are you doing, buddy?
For Nicole Tandy, she's happily one and done.
The idea of adding another child to the family just feels impossible.
She hopes that by speaking openly about the hard, unglamorous parts of parenting, others might feel less alone and prompt a rethink of how Australia supports families.
Connor Duffy and Rhiannon Hobbins with that report. And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Barbara Miller.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Will the war in Iran and the chaos that comes with it trigger China to invade Taiwan? It's a question raising its head again, especially after Donald Trump's recent visit to Beijing. Today, Samir Puri, visiting lecturer in war studies at King's College London, on President Xi Jinping's warning to Trump. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.